This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. I've got a terrific show lined up for you today. Momentarily, I'll be chatting with Mr. Howard B. Hill. Howard's a very interesting guy. His book is Finance Monsters, and Howard was one of Wall Street's original rocket scientists. He actually helped package up a lot of the derivative type loans and created some financial products. So I thought it'd be a great perspective to get. And we're also going to get Mr. Hill's take on, is another financial crisis likely or even imminent? And certainly you're going to want to stay tuned and listen to that conversation. Also on today's program, I will be chatting about the difference between currency and money. And I am going to spend both segments 2 and 4 on the topic today. What I'm going to talk about is, I think, an important perspective for managing your nest egg. Knowing the difference between currency and money, as I'm going to describe it, I think will not only be very important, but in my opinion, vital to prospering in what may lie ahead from an economic perspective. I think a lot of financial professionals are not familiar with this difference. And when you study history, the difference between currency and money becomes very, very clear and very obvious. So I'll be talking about that on the second and fourth segments of today's program. I want to remind you also that we do have another new retirement rules class coming up where we talk about these topics in depth. The next class will be held in January on the 24th. At the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information, all you have to do is visit newretirementrules.com, and you can get information about the class or register for the class while capacity remains. The class is just held on Saturday from 9 o'clock until 2:30. The cost is $49 for you and a guest, and that includes a lunch as well. So again, more information is available at newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program today, Mr. Howard Hill. Howard was one of Wall Street's original rocket scientists. His innovative bond structures helped lower the cost of home financing on three continents, and the analytic techniques he pioneered have become essential for investors and risk managers and many of our largest financial institutions. Howard is credited with an unequaled number of industry firsts in the securitization market. His team executed first-time securitizations that lowered financing costs for apartment buildings, equipment leases, mobile home parks, nursing homes, and life insurance policy loans. After working at investment firms for 25 years, Howard now trades his own account and writes the popular blog mindonmoney.wordpress.com. His book, Finance Monsters, is what we want to talk to Howard about today. And Howard, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
Howard, let me just ask, because we are talking about, we were talking before we started to record our conversation about the financial crisis. Let me ask you, just going back to someone who worked in the trenches when it came to these securitizations, subprime mortgages get a lot of the blame for the last financial crisis, but what caused the financial crisis back in 2007, 2008?
Well, in my opinion, subprime mortgage credit problems were, you know, definitely the spark, but there wouldn't have been the fire if there hadn't been a system that allowed people to create additional credit risk triggered or keyed on those subprime mortgage bonds and trade them all over the world. That was the credit default swap market.
Howard, for our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with what that term additional credit risk means and what a credit default swap is, give us a 101 level explanation.
Okay. A credit default swap, the easiest way to think of it is as a form of bond insurance that someone could buy if they own a bond or if they want to just speculate that the bond might default in the future. And because it was, at the time, a completely unregulated and undisclosed business, the limitation on the number of insurance policies that could be written wasn't related at all to the number of bonds that were outstanding. So, for example, when we all got surprised by AIG going down. It turned out that, you know, AIG, that had no exposure directly to the mortgage market of that mattered, had hundreds of billions of dollars of exposure via writing these insurance policies called credit default swaps. And it was margin calls on those insurance policies that really took AIG down, even before there were losses in the mortgage bonds they were insuring.
So, Howard, since the financial crisis, there have been regulatory reforms, or I should say maybe attempts at regulatory reforms. Dodd-Frank is one that comes to mind. Has this problem been adequately addressed, or is it possible that we could see a repeat of the financial crisis, as so many of my guests have predicted?
Well, I think that we're actually set up to have a repeat sometime, somehow. I can't tell you what the trigger will be, although lately the discussion is whether the falling oil price might serve as that spark that lights the next big trouble. And the reason for that would be that if there were enough bets out there against those junk energy company bonds, then the outfits that wrote those insurance contracts, banks and reinsurance companies primarily, they might end up owing more than the amount of the bonds. And we could have, again, a situation that ripples through the entire financial system with no one knowing who has the exposure. And that's probably the biggest danger in all this, is that once you know there are large losses somebody has to take, if you don't know who it is, then you can't do business with anyone. And that's how the financial market froze in 2008.
So, Howard, I'm sure that some of the listeners listening to this conversation are having a very difficult time believing that it's hard to know what the size of these ultimate liabilities might be. How is that possible that this isn't being tracked or regulated?
Well, you do have, in some small way, the total amount outstanding. You get quarterly reports from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency that shows gross exposure to these credit default swaps at U.S. banks. I think the last quarter, the total was $2.77 trillion. They don't say where they are, you know, which banks have what exposure. So if you were just looking at a given, let's say, a shale oil energy company that got, you know, a little bit out over its ski tips and is now going to have trouble with oil prices down here at 60, there might be on a single bond 10 or 20 or 100 times as many of the insurance policies written as there are bonds. And you won't know which bank has those insurance policies on their books.
Howard, I had a guest on the program who I think said that when you look at exposure, derivative exposure at the too big to fail banks, that it's actually now about 20% higher than it was prior to the financial crisis. What would be your opinion? Does that sound like that's on target in your view?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think the last total figure of derivative exposures in the OCC report was around $280 trillion. Pretty amazing, given that we've got, what, a $17 trillion economy?
That is mind-boggling that exposure is, what, probably 17 or 18 times the size of the economy. What kind of risk, I mean, with 200 and, let's just say, $80 trillion of derivative exposure, what kind of risk is that? Might that pose for a bank?
Well, the banks do calculate, and the OCC reports, and I should probably go online and log it up, log on and find out again. But as best I can recall, without looking at the numbers, I think there was somewhere around just shy, maybe $377 billion was the figure for, quote, value at risk. Now, that's kind of a faulty measurement, one that unfortunately causes bull and bust cycles. Because what happens is value at risk looks back over the last 100 days or a year and says, okay, 95% of my daily price moves in these things was less than a certain amount. And they say, okay, that's the value at risk, as long as we've got 95% confidence that's our one-day price move. Unfortunately, the more stable a market gets as it goes upward, that measure gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it breaks out, at which point it triggers margin calls, collateral calls, fear in the market, all those things that can cause a sudden break. So if it is, say, $377 trillion today, or billion, in exposure at the five biggest banks, that probably could immediately become $1 trillion with just a simple break in pricing on these derivative instruments. All they have to do is go outside the envelope they've been trading for the last 100 days or a year.
All right. Well, we are chatting today with Mr. Howard B. Hill. The book is Finance Monsters, and we'll continue our conversation with Mr. Hill when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're with me today, and hope you're having a beginning of a really good holiday week. You know, in this segment, I want to talk about a fiat currency, and I want to talk about something that very few folks, from my experience, understand, and very few financial professionals understand. And that's something called the currency money cycle. And we'll talk about the differences between currency and money in this segment. And just to get started, let me just talk about some of the features of money. And what is money? Well, money is really just a tool for trading your time. It's a container, if you will, to store your economic energy until you're ready to deploy it. Well, isn't that what currency is? Well, no, currency is really not money. Currency is a money imposter that's quietly stealing your two most valuable assets, your time and your freedom. And substituting currency for money is a cycle that keeps repeating itself, and we call that the currency money cycle. Now, what is the currency money cycle? Well, initially, money and currency are the same thing. Money and currency, often, historically speaking, were gold. Gold and silver have been a good store of value over time, and gold and silver have often been money over time. Then as time goes on, and politicians tend to overspend, money and currency become two different things. So just to ask yourself this question, and answer this question for yourself, given three choices, which of these choices do you think politicians often take when it comes to balancing your budget or closing a deficit? They can either A, raise taxes, they can B, cut spending, or they can C, print currency. What do they do? Well, you're exactly right. If you said C, that's typically what's happened historically. Now, what is currency? Let's define that just to kind of frame our conversation here in this segment. Currency is, one, a medium of exchange. You can exchange it for goods or services. It's a unit of account. It's portable. It's easy to move around. Hopefully, it's durable. Hopefully, it's divisible. You can make change. And it's fungible. And fungible is a term meaning that each unit is the same as the next. So currency is a medium of exchange, a unit of account. It's portable, divisible, durable, and fungible. Money is all those things as well. Money is a medium of exchange, a unit of account. It's portable, durable, divisible, and fungible. But money, and this is what's important, money is a store of value over a long period of time. Well, just to talk about the difference between currency and money, let me go back and explore with you the currency money cycle. See, if you go way back in history, you can go back to Rome, and we're going to explore that here momentarily, but just go back in U.S. history. You know, at the beginning of the United States history as a country, back in 1792, an act was passed called the Mint Act. And the Mint Act made gold and silver currency. Well, the currency had intrinsic value. It was a good store of value over time. So at this point, currency and money were the same thing. Then as time passed, you might find that paper money is used. But initially, anyway, paper money has a direct link to hard money. So the paper money or currency can be exchanged for a fixed amount of silver or gold. So just think back to something called a silver certificate. Some of you probably are old enough to remember a silver certificate. A silver certificate, which these were actually printed from, I believe, 1878 through 1965. These silver certificates were redeemable for a fixed amount of real silver. So you could take the paper currency and you could go exchange it for the real money. So at this point, currency and money had a direct link. Then, the most recent example of currency and money becoming two different things happened when Richard Nixon, in 1971, eliminated that link between the dollar and gold, the dollar and something tangible. Since that time, currency and money have been two different things. And let me just give you an example to really make the point and explain the difference between currency and money. In 1984, the cost of a gallon of gasoline was a little bit more than a buck. So if you had to go fill up a gas tank and it had 15 gallons to fill it up, it would take $15. And since silver was about $6 to $7 an ounce, let's just say it would take a little bit more than 2 ounces of silver or real money to fill up that gas tank. Well, today, silver is selling for around 16 bucks an ounce. If we take the same 15-gallon gas tank and we want to fill up that gas tank at roughly $2.50 a gallon, nationally speaking, it still takes about the same 2 ounces of silver to fill up the gas tank, but it takes a lot more currency. Well, that is key to understanding the difference between currency and money. And as politicians decide to print currency rather than raise taxes or cut spending or balance the budget in an honest way, currency becomes a very poor store of value. Now, the currency that you have in your pocket, it is a medium of exchange and a unit of account. It has numbers on it, so it's divisible. You can make change. It's portable. It's somewhat durable. It's fungible because a dollar in my pocket buys the same as a dollar in your pocket. But because governments can print more and more currency and dilute the currency supply, currency is not a good store of value over time. The dollar, since the Federal Reserve was established and money printing actually could occur, that was happened all the way back in 1913. And since that time, the dollar as a currency has lost over 95% of its purchasing power. So when this money printing occurs, wealth is transferred from you and your bank account in the form of decreased buying power. And where does that wealth get transferred to? It gets transferred to the government and to the banking system. That's why the wealth gap, the disparity between those who are wealthy and those that are who are not, is wider now than it has been at any point in recent history. That is because of monetary policy and the Federal Reserve printing more currency and making currency and money something different. We talk about this in our new retirement rules class, and we talk about what this means for your nest egg and how you manage money. And we talk about historically what's happened and what have been good stores of value and how should you incorporate this into your retirement plans. Our new retirement rules class is resuming again on January the 24th. It'll be at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like more information on the class, all you have to do is visit the website newretirementrules.com. The website again is newretirementrules.com, and you can register there while capacity remains. We'll be back. Stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have had the pleasure of chatting for one segment already, Mr. Howard B. Hill, author of Finance Monsters, and I'm going to have the pleasure of chatting with him again this segment. Howard, if our listeners wanted to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Oh, well, I mean, other than reading the book, which I hope is accessible to everyone with an ordinary financial education and not just grad students and professionals, I'd say they could read my blog, Mind on Money, as well. There's starting to be quite a few more sources that tell them some things. A good example would be those OCC reports. I find them quite interesting and actually pretty easily accessible and well written.
Well, Howard, let's talk about, we talked about the fact that it's your view that given the risk on the balance sheet of many banks with these bets between banks, if you will, that a repeat of the financial crisis certainly is possible. We focused our conversation really on just the United States, but comment for our listeners on how much of an international problem this is.
Well, globally, it's an even bigger problem, of course, and you can't these days limit the action of particularly the big speculators to one country or one continent. The last time I thought that we might have another financial crisis, a bigger one, triggered was when the Greek default occurred, 2 years ago?
Right.
And at the time, I using the numbers from the Bank of International Settlements, it was close to $93 billion paid out to the winners on that credit default swap bet. But those winners weren't in Greece. They weren't the investors in pension funds that held Greek bonds, probably mostly in Europe. Those winners were hedge funds sitting in the Caymans or, you know, guys in Greenwich, Connecticut, or wherever. So it suddenly transfers money from one place to another across borders, which is another very odd thing about this brave new world of financial risk being created out of thin air and then traded.
So, Howard, let's talk about more specifically how a credit default swap works. For our listeners' benefit, would it be fair to say that it's a zero-sum game? If somebody loses X, somebody else has to gain X? Explain a bit about how that might be structured between a couple entities.
Okay. Well, originally, and until 2005, almost everyone was more or less like getting insurance on your car. So if you bought this credit insurance on a bond, and then the bond defaulted, you delivered the bond to your counterparty that wrote you the insurance policy, and they paid you the face amount on the bond. That'd be just like getting your car totaled, and you have to give the car to the insurance company, and they do whatever they can to get the salvage, you know, out of that car. The problem that happened, and I believe it was Delphi Corp. It was either Delphi or Dana. They both, the two auto parts makers, they both defaulted in 2005-2006. And I think it was to everyone's surprise that there was $20 billion in insurance outstanding with only $2 billion in bonds. So the entire swap market had to wake up and figure out a different way to settle these insurance contracts. And they ended up building what they called an auction process. So what that consists of is 10 or a dozen dealers each bidding on the what they call salvage value of the bond. That establishes then the price the credit default swap will settle at. The biggest one, I believe, was Fannie Mae with $400 billion of credit default swaps. And when Fannie Mae got taken over, that was judged to be a default event. Now, never mind that none of the bondholders actually lost any money. The taxpayers stepped up and, you know, made them good on that. The default contract ended up settling, I think, around 91 or 91 and a half cents. So on that $400 billion, the guys who bought the credit default swap contracts each made about 9 cents on the dollar. But since they only paid probably a quarter or a half a percent, that was a great return for them. So the total paid out was roughly $36 billion on the Fannie Mae default on $400 billion face amount of credit default swaps. So on Greece, I think the settlement price was 21.5, which meant then the payoff was 78.5 cents on the dollar for each dollar of credit default swaps outstanding.
So
it varies by bond.
Okay, so let's shift gears a minute. If all this exposure leads to another financial crisis, in your view, does it look like the last one? And how will our average listener, who might have a 401k or an IRA out there, be affected?
Well, the biggest way they'd be affected would be the sudden removal of liquidity from the market. The real reason, I believe, that 2008 resulted in action by every central bank and every government to guarantee their banks. It almost didn't matter what their political system was, what their constitution said. All the banks got guaranteed everywhere. And I think the primary reason for that was the crucial role these banks play in trade finance. Basically, you had wheat piling up on the at the docks in New Orleans because they couldn't get three-month financing to deliver it wherever it was needed. And iron ore was piling up in Australia because it had to be shipped to China, but it needed a letter of credit from a bank, and nobody knew if the bank was going to be any good for the payment 3 months or 4 months later when the iron ore would finally get to China. So that fundamental trade finance is the real reason that there was a global bailout, in my opinion. And the reason that that fundamental trade finance froze was because no one knew which banks might be insolvent. So, all we knew was that there was potentially trillions of dollars of insurance settlements that needed to be paid, and that the banks were the counterparties to the hedge funds or others who were betting against this credit. And even if the banks had laid off their risk, did they know that the place they laid it off was going to be able to pay? In that case, it was AIG. So AIG had hundreds of billions of dollars of, call it secondary insurance or reinsurance. And again, my personal opinion, that's the reason AIG had all of their claims paid at 100 cents on the dollar. When there were some smaller insurance companies, outfits like Ambac, at the same time, that had almost identical contracts, and those were being negotiated at 10 and 15 cents on the dollar. Problem was, if Goldman Sachs and Citi and so on don't get that 100 cents on the dollar out of AIG, but they do have to pay it to, say, the hedge fund that took the bet on the other side, then the bank was going to be out of business.
So how would you rate, you know, given this conversation we're having, which is enlightening as to how all this transpired and what the risk is today, rate, if you would, the solvency of the banking system today, or maybe compare it to where it was back in 2007?
Well, it's I'd say two-thirds of the way toward where it needs to be. And at the time, it was only one-third of the way. And the reason I say that is because at the time the crisis started to really ramp up in 2008, there were collateral agreements on about one-third of all the credit default swaps out there. And now there are collateral agreements on about two-thirds. So from that standpoint, at least there's margin that's been put up. That covers 1 or 2 or 5 days of potential loss to the bank if their counterparty fails. I mean, what you're afraid of is a domino effect. One failure from a small player makes a big player also fail, and then, you know, you're off to the races. It's a chain reaction that runs through the whole system. So part of what's been done is to create exchanges. See, the reason we don't worry about somebody losing their shirt in options or futures is because everybody does their trade with the futures exchange or the options exchange. So we all know that everybody has the same collateral required, and they've made their deposits, and the collateral calls go out from the options exchange. And if you bought a put or a call, you're going to get paid if you're a winner, because they've got this setup that's already got the money from the potential losers. What they don't have, and they're starting to try to set that up in the swaps business, but they've got loopholes that you could drive a truck through, well, or a whale, in the case of the London whale trade from J.P. Morgan. There was nothing that required those swaps that J.P. Morgan was entering in that trade to be reported or to be collateralized, because they were called portfolio hedging. That's the real problem. We need to get all the trades onto a central clearing and transparent, and then at least those of the rest of us in the market can see when things are moving and when really huge positions are in place, and we can move to protect ourselves. But if we can't see the positions, then we can't know. It's like the totally submerged iceberg tearing open the hull of our ship. Well, so that to me is the real solution. Get everything out in the open and then let the market deal with it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Howard B. Hill. Howard is the author of Finance Monsters. I would encourage you to check it out. Howard, been a pleasure chatting with you. We hope you'll come back.
Oh, thanks, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program, and thanks to Mr. Howard Hill for giving us his perspectives on this week's program. In this segment, I want to continue to talk about the currency money cycle. If you're just joining us or didn't happen to catch the prior segment during which I talked about the differences between currency and money, let me again give you a brief definition just to frame the conversation. Currency is all these things. Currency is a medium of exchange. You can use it in commerce. It's a unit of account. It's portable. It's easy to move around. It's durable, which means it lasts for a period of time. It's divisible, which means you can use it in commerce and you can make change. And it's fungible, which is a term that simply means that each unit is the same as the next. Now, money is all those things also. Money is a medium of exchange. Money is a unit of account. Money is portable, durable, divisible, and fungible. Plus, money is a store of value over a long period of time. Now, as we talk, since the Federal Reserve was formed back in 1913, the dollar has lost more than 95% of its purchasing power. So that demonstrates that currency is not a very good store of value. Now, this cycle, this currency money cycle, has repeated itself time and time again throughout history. This time, we believe, will be no different. In fact, all you have to do is go back and look at what happened during the Roman Empire. During the Roman Empire, if you think about the time of Caesar, this was about 0 to maybe 5 AD. Money, at this point, was currency. Currency was money. The unit of exchange was the denarius, and the denarius was comprised of nearly 100% silver. So silver, having tangible value, was used in commerce, so money and currency were the same thing. Now, after Caesar, along came Augustus. And Augustus said, wow, we are spending a lot of money here. We're raising military pay to keep the military on our side. We need to have some more money. Well, he went about creating more money in a fairly honest way. He simply ordered the mines to overproduce silver in an attempt to finance the empire that had grown so greatly under his predecessor Caesar and himself. Well, this overproduction of silver created inflation, so Augustus decided to cut back a bit on the production of silver to get inflation under control. Now, that was the last time that a Roman emperor attempted to honestly correct a monetary policy blunder. And we'll talk next week on the program with our guest, Mr. Carl Lane, who is a history professor, who will talk about a similar time, I believe, in U.S. history when President Andrew Jackson, the seventh president of the United States, actually paid off the national debt in 1835. And incidentally, if you're not aware, President Jackson was the seventh president of the United States, and President Jackson was the last president to pay off the national debt. Since that time, the national debt has never been paid. So you might liken that to this period of time in the Roman Empire under Augustus. Now, after Augustus, things began to deteriorate rather quickly. Rome was spending a lot more money than they had, and they had the same three choices that any modern-day politician has in any country. In order to finance this expanded government, they could raise taxes, not a very popular choice politically. They could cut spending. However, under the Roman Empire, the Roman leaders had gained really political favor by providing a lot of government benefits, not unlike the situation that we see today. The third choice that the Roman emperors have would be to print currency. That's what they decided to do. Now, how did they do that? Because the currency and money being used at the time was silver. Well, they simply decided to start debasing the money, debasing the coins. In fact, it was Nero who first came up with this idea in AD 64. And Emperor Nero said, gather a whole bunch of coins back in. Let's melt down the silver content of those coins, and let's melt in some copper. And we'll make the intrinsic or tangible or real value of the money less. Yet, we'll have it maintain the same buying power. So at this point, the money began to become a store of value that was not as efficient, and money started to transition toward currency. It's a really important point to understand. Well, if you turn the clock ahead about 200 more years, by AD 75, the denarius was now 20 parts copper to 1 part silver. In other words, the denarius contained less than 5% of the silver that it had a couple hundred years prior. The result? We had runaway inflation in Rome. In fact, whenever you see money being replaced by currency, the outcomes historically have been very, very similar. In AD 301, the Roman emperor tried his hand at reform. In fact, he instituted price control, saying, wow, inflation's out of control, so we're going to put in place price controls, and we're going to dictate to merchants what they can sell goods and services for. Well, price controls are basically an idiocy. They never work. In fact, one needs only to take a look at what happened in Venezuela recently. Venezuela, as a result of printing a lot of currency, has seen massive inflation. The country of Venezuela has seen inflation approaching 60% annually. And rather than implementing honest monetary policy, the government there decided to implement price controls, just like the Roman Empire did back in AD 301, almost 2,000 years ago. The outcome 2,000 years ago is really the outcome that we saw in Venezuela recently. We see price controls cause goods to disappear from the marketplace. As soon as you tell an entrepreneur or a businessman or a farmer that you have to sell something for less than it cost you to produce it, they quit producing it. Imagine if you're selling milk. And you now have to sell that milk for less than it cost you to produce it. It won't take you long to realize that your business is now a hobby that's costing you money, and you'll do something different. That happened in Rome, and it also happened in Venezuela recently. Argentina is another example. This is a predictable outcome of currency printing, which is a predictable outcome of creating a fiat currency. Now, admittedly, when you look at the time that took place during the Roman Empire, it took about 200 years for the denarius to become a fiat currency, and it took another 30 years for price controls to be implemented. So these changes don't happen quickly, but the patterns are unmistakable. Now, another outcome of printing currency is that you see that you develop something called a trade deficit. That happened in Rome as well. And if that doesn't sound a bit familiar, then you probably haven't studied recent U.S. history, because when the U.S. dollar became a fiat currency back in 1971, it didn't take too many years that the United States, after that, became a net importer, not a net exporter. And the simple fact is that when you buy more than you sell, that trend can't continue for very long. Now, unfortunately, the sad truth is that we today mirror Rome. In fact, to give you a couple examples, back prior to 1933, there was a 1 ounce gold coin, which was a $20 gold piece that circulated throughout the United States. At this time, money was currency. In fact, gold was $20 an ounce from 1834 through 1933. And point to point, over that time frame, that 99-year time frame, there was no price inflation. Now, at a certain point in 1971, we saw the dollar become a complete fiat currency, and then we saw the buying power of that dollar begin to be reduced. So the currency money cycle is repeating itself historically time and time again, because politicians as a group collectively have only three choices to deal with debt excesses and deficits. They can raise taxes, cut spending, or print currency, and they always opt for the same outcome. Now, historically speaking, fiat currencies have a 100% failure rate. I want to briefly, just in the interest of time, share with you a study done by the Daily Reckoning. They studied fiat currencies, and they examined every fiat currency that ever existed that began with the letter A, and half of the fiat currencies that ever existed that began with the letter B. There were 600 currencies examined in total. 100% of them failed. We believe the outcome today can be no different. Our upcoming class, newretirementrules.com, is where you can get more information. That's our program for this week. Thanks for listening.